At Ritual, we're celebrating all moms this Mother's Day, current and aspiring. So whether you're looking for fertility support, natal choline, or our best-selling clinically backed prenatal, we've got you covered. Find your Ritual. Go to ritual.com/podcast and for a limited time, get 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Based on net sales from industry data, including Nielsen IQ, Stackline, and Numerator as of Q4 2024 and top 5 products.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Gray Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. We're going to be putting this episode out on May 12th. This is an episode where we've started with Giant Size X-Men number one at the start of this year, and we get to celebrate all of these incredible characters who are introduced into our X-Men world at this time. My top favorite of all of them is, of course, Storm. We're not doing the Trial of Storm for a little while. I'm going to make you all wait, but I'm a huge fan of Aurora Monroe, and I've done a lot of content related to Storm on my show, oddly. I've talked with Annie Nesenti when she was writing her Storm series. I've done some Storm reviews on her early stuff. We've even done an episode on the Monroe family, on David and Indare and their incredible journey. So it's really fun to be interviewing the two writers who are currently working on Aurora Monroe, the incredible Marewa Ayodele, who is doing Storm's solo book, and the wonderful Jed McKay, who is writing both X-Men and Avengers, which, dude, that's insane. But you've got Storm on your main cast. So I'd love to have you both introduce yourselves to our listeners, tell them your name and pronouns. What's your favorite, what's the thing that you've discovered about Storm as you have written her? Like, what's something that really stands out as something you found about her along the way? And that's our intro question today.
Yeah, it's good to be back. I'm trying to make my answer impressive so Jet doesn't give a more thoughtful answer and then I feel all...
I don't think there's much danger of that.
So my name is Marewa Ayodele, currently writing the Storm solo series for Marvel Comics. While doing my research for Storm and writing Storm, something I've particularly been drawn to when it comes to Storm is the fact that she has this deep history with always being knocked down. You know, she lost her parents, you know, she grew up almost worse than poor, basically growing up on the streets. But despite everything she's been through, she carries herself like someone that doesn't have that background. You know, if you'd see her, you would think maybe she grew up in a rich family because of this so much confidence that oozes out of her. She doesn't allow her background to determine how she carries herself. And that's something I'm always particularly drawn to. You know, when someone, especially for someone like from Nigeria, you know, interacting with a lot of people from other countries and anything, and the fact that you should be able to interact with everybody with that same level of confidence, like, yeah, I can be here too, you know. So that's something I've always been drawn with that, and something I enjoy researching and also writing.
You're both writing Storm as incredibly self-possessed. She knows herself. She'll learn a lesson if she needs to, but she's very confident in what she has to offer. And I love seeing that self-possession with her. That's not always been her journey along the way. You know, sometimes she's a little bit opaque. Let me also welcome the incredible Jed McKay back to the show. Hi, Jed.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on. It's always good to chat. Hi, my name is Jed McKay. Pronouns are he, him. I'm currently writing X-Men and Avengers. And in Avengers, we brought Storm onto the team in issue 18. I don't know. If you follow me on Blue Sky, you know I never know the numbers of my own comics. But yeah, as far as things that I like about Storm, I've learned about Storm, is that I think that level of self-possession, I think, is a great way to phrase it, and that she has the bearing of a character who, you know, is entirely sure of herself, knows her position in the world, knows her position in relation to other people, and usually it's above them, because she just, you know, it's Storm. She's the boss. But the thing is, that's what I knew going in. I felt when I was working with this latest Avengers story, this heist job, is that I think Storm is a character that can also be very funny. It's not all just being serious. It's not all I'm the Queen of the Winds, et cetera, you know, reached Racco. You know, she can tell a joke. In Avengers, we have her and Wanda essentially putting on a fake fight to act as a distraction. Yeah. And it was a lot of fun to take a character who has such self-confidence, such assurance in their bearing and in the way they carry themselves and their mien, and to kind of, you know, twist that a little bit and see that they can laugh. They can take that self-seriousness and still be relatable and, you know, a fun character. And that's something that I was pleased to discover as we went on.
So I have a series of questions, and we're going to start from a very serious place. And we're going to keep this very storm focused, but I want to just celebrate what the two of you are doing in the books right now. Jed, I love your Moon Knight. I got to reread your entire Avengers and X-Men run this last week, which I love to do because I can see where you're going with things. The mix of
continuity. You do that every week, right, Chad?
I don't read every issue every week, but I definitely read them as they come out. But to read it all in one sitting is a different thing, you know? The way you are mixing in new characters with the deep continuity and like the very simple and easy ways that you honor character through the conversations. I don't know that I see a lot of writers doing that in their team books in the way that you do. You can pair two characters together and the conversation they have matters and tells you where they've come from. I'm so impressed with your ability to do that. And I always love when you surprise me with a deep continuity dive. So I have some questions based on some of those things along the way.
Sure.
And Marewa, you're writing Storm as a goddess. I've read some of your work now, right? We've talked about some of your other books, but she is raised to a level of elevation that is just beautiful. Sure, and right. Art, that like 3-page spread by Lucas where she goes to dinner with Doom and puts on her lingerie and her knives and her green dress. I was like, fuck yes, it's so good. Okay, so I want to start with a heavy place. I'm a therapist in my day job. I work with the trans community. I'm also a gay man who has two queer children. This is a fucking terrible time in our world right now. In America, things feel dark and heavy, and I apologize to the countries of Canada and Nigeria for anyone listening for what is happening in this country right now, although I'm not responsible. It's embarrassing and it's really exhausting. And I know we're seeing conservative politics kind of hit different places. It's an odd thing because I don't think this was planned, but the fall of Krakoa happened last year. I got to have Tom Brevoort and Jordan White on for the same episode where we were kind of grieving Krakoa and talking about the potential of what's going to happen. And the real world parallel of this is very interesting because if we're taking the theme of queer people who during the Obama administration started to get kind of a place at the table a little bit, we started like feeling like we belonged and we had a voice and that democracy works for us. And then with this second Trump election in particular, it's kind of like they're like, fuck you, you don't exist, get out. And I'm going to draw some of these parallels as we talk today. Trans people who are being thrown into prisons that do not match their genders. Can you imagine a worse thing than being a woman in a man's prison? My word, people who fled their countries for being queer and are now being tossed into internment camps. It's disgusting and it's stuff that we don't associate with the free world, right? It's really humiliating. The parallel here also, and we look at our X-Men books, which is always an interesting experiment, is we now have the X-Men divided up into isolated groups. They are disagreeing. They don't know how to proceed. People are feeling helpless and giving up and grieving what they've lost in very different ways. And I think the two of you are writing different books that capture that in very different ways. But this kind of isolationist space and this inability to know how to proceed, while mutants are literally being rounded up and thrown into prisons where they're tortured at the same time. It's a really odd but kind of uncomfortable parallel, but we love superhero fiction that celebrates real world things. So I want to start from this kind of heavy place, and I'm going to ask you both a couple heavy hitting questions as we talk about this for just a moment. Jed, let me start with you. In one of your recent Avengers books, before Storm joined the team, you had your Avengers going in and like fighting off Orcus, and you've had the characters talking about like, here's why we waited so long to do this. You've had Storm kind of representing the mutant voice with Sam Wilson, Carol Danvers, and other characters about like, you know, we need to be united. The conversation you had recently between Carol Danvers and Cyclops, where they're like, okay, we need to be united and like work together, trust each other because mutants matter. It's the stuff that when you're reading the Marvel Universe as a whole, people aren't addressing the mutant issue and it makes you crazy, right? And I love seeing you put that stuff on the page. How has it been for you organizing the dynamics of like mutant politics and desperation in this like real world, real threat Avengers world? And then the comparison of the two. I'm very impressed with how deftly you're handling this.
It's like I said, it's a tricky thing to do because one of the kind of realities of working in the larger superhero world in Marvel, this kind of shared universe, is that ultimately there will be things that the Avengers can't solve, because otherwise, why would there be another book? And the same thing, you know, the X-Men can't count on the Avengers or anybody else to solve all their problems, because then every book is an X-Men. It's one of those things that grinds my gears when people say, oh, well, where were the Avengers during Genosha? And it's like, well, they were being bounced around time by Kang. Like, you can't, these are not parallels you can bring into a comic book world and have it make sense. So, but at the same time, you do have to have this acknowledgement of the wider world that these characters are living in, the things that are happening. So, you know, we had that Fall of X crossover in Avengers. And, you know, a lot of it was saying, like, this is why we waited this long, because You know, we have Tony Stark setting up things on the sidelines. But also part of it is that the Avengers couldn't solve the Orcus thing, because then there'd be no story in X-Men, right? Like, this is a thing that has to happen in X-Men. Similarly, you know, we have the X-Men fighting, we've got Gray Malkin prison exists. I can't have the X-Men going flat in Gray Malkin prison, because that's the story that Gail's telling. I'm not going to go and tell the story that she's writing. So I think it's one of those things that I think it's very natural for people to bring up in that way and say, well, why doesn't someone fix this thing that is this world? Oh, they don't. It's because no one cares about mutants, or, oh, Spider-Man does give a shit about what Daredevil's doing, right? That. But ultimately, it comes down to is these stories need to be told in the books that are telling the stories. Otherwise, there's no point to it. So it's something that is a very delicate kind of line to tread, to have this acknowledgement of greater issues in the comic book world among these characters, while also allowing, not stepping on everyone else's toes and not, you know, bigfooting in and saying, okay, well, guess what? Orcus doesn't exist anymore. The Avengers stopped them. I don't know what you're doing to follow X now, but have fun with that. You know what I mean? So that's the trick. You want to make the world feel real. You want to make it feel connected. You want to make it feel lived in. But at the same time, not go around and screwing all your colleagues over in the stories that they're trying to tell.
I think that's very fair, but I think you can do it in a couple lines of dialogue, right? You're writing Idiot and Magneto talking about the injustice of the Pit and how she doesn't grieve Krakoa in the same way. You can do something in a couple of lines that really tells you where the character's at, without having to go solve the real world of problems. But I think as a reader, it's so valuable to see that on the page. Marewa, you're writing Storm in Atlanta, the Storm Sanctuary above the city. You open your book with Storm seemingly running for Congress and then making a decision to tell the truth about something that ends up having kind of a blowback on mutants. It's a bold beginning for the book that, of course, results in the radiation poisoning and then the story that you're going on from there. Tell me about the decision to have Storm begin there, addressing these real world problems as an African American woman in Atlanta running on this platform.
I think I usually have a different view of what being an Avenger is. I think I always see Avengers almost like police officers, but not in the way most people think, almost like authority figures, not, oh yeah, go arrest people, but people that are, in the ideal sense of the word, people that have this authority to sacrifice for us, and we look up to them. And I've always been fascinated about relationships where the African-American police officer and the situation that he's always put under, where sometimes the police might seem like they're coming hard, especially on this particular demography. What happens when you belong to that demography as well? And it's a very tricky thing to balance, you know? So it's, what if on a rare occasion, people always assume, oh yeah, it's this demography that did this thing. It's this demography that did this thing. What about on the rare occasion where they are correct? What do you do? Do you cover it up, or do you still remain someone of integrity? And it's always been something I've been fascinated about and always wanted to tell that kind of story. And I know that's what a lot of people that belong to those demographics face every single day. It happens too as a Nigerian. Nigerians are known for, you know, being in leading fields in medicine and in science. But at the same time, they're also known to be leaders in fraud, internet fraud. And it's weird sometimes, you know, when someone says, oh yeah, this person was a Nigerian, and it's not true, it's probably maybe somebody else, you know. There was a Nigerian prince that was arrested some time ago, and it was a white man, you know. It had nothing to do with Nigeria whatsoever, you know. But what about the rare occasion where it's actually a Nigerian? And, you know, you're just like, oh, damn, you know. But do you, because of that, lose your integrity? There's no real answer to it. It's not saying that, oh yeah, people's assumptions, prejudice is always bad, you know, but it's just a state of life that sometimes even a broken clock can be correct, even though it's a broken clock that we should get rid of. And it happens. And when you are someone trying to do right, you are put in that situation where it feels like the wrong people are correct. Mm-hmm. And you just have to maintain yourself and still maintain your integrity rather than bending towards what's up, because it happens sometimes where, let's say, you believe you belong to this group and there's another group that we think they are evil and they are this and they are that, and all that might be true. But I think to have a proper discourse in society, it always makes sense where when that other party is correct, we should be able to say, yeah, that's correct. Rather than always, because they're this other party, we should always oppose everything they say, because yeah. That is what we are. So it's when they are correct, people say yes. And when they are wrong, people say no, that's yeah. wrong. And it's that kind of thing I was trying to explore with that story.
When there was the Trump assassination attempt last year and the bullet like narrowly missed him, a lot of people believe that was a ruse or a plant. I fully understand. But I remember having nearly a panic attack afterward. Like, was this a gay shooter? Was this a black shooter? Because if it was, suddenly the narrative shifts very much. And almost there was a sense yeah. of relief when it was a white straight guy, which is an odd thing to consider. But we have to like consider that in minority groups, I think, about like what this means. But Storm's determination to tackle the problem and to like take whatever's in front of her, and I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to make it happen.
But also, as a white straight guy, it's okay to feel like that. We'll take it. It's good. Don't worry.
I wasn't worried. Fun for the rest of the show, but I just wanted to sure. start with that kind of resonance, because our X-Men comics always delve into that very serious sure. space a little bit. Ryan North is currently writing Fantastic Four, and one of my favorite runs, and we've got the One World Under Doom stuff happening right now, which is also a very odd parallel of here's this really horrible person who seems to be doing good things for the world, but also tick, 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 right? Like there's something really yeah. bad about to happen. Mariwa, your issue with Storm at dinner with Dr. Doom for the third time acknowledged, and the balance between that and her just beautiful connection with her father, as we got to flash back to her childhood and have her reunite with him, that was such a delicate and wonderful balance. What was it like for you writing Storm playing off Dr. Doom? Because what a connection.
Yeah, I think the first thing is when Tom Brevoort reached out to me to write Storm, he always had the plan that there would be an interaction between Storm and Dr. Doom. In fact, it was supposed to come as early as a second issue, but I kind of pushed it because I wanted to tell some stories to like issue 4. And at that time, I was still trying to decide on what the story would be about. I already had this idea that Storm would be in space, and there will be some things with Ego, the living planet, and stuff like that. And Nova will be involved. And then Storm will put on Nova's helmet, and she'll be called the Nova Storm, you know. And then I find out that I think there's one of the Transformers as Nova Storm or something. So I was like, no. So because I kept thinking, and then I discovered the Rogue Storm thing and some other connection she had with Eternity. And then I was like, yeah, Eternal Storm. That makes sense. And I saw how Rogue Storm was activated. It was through the first dinner with Dr. Doom. So I was like, this makes sense. So, and if this is the third one, you know, the third one should be like this reconnection with the first. So I wanted Dr. Doom to be the one that activates Eternal Storm like it did in their first dinner. And also based on the landscape, on is going to be the new ruler of the world and everything, I wanted to play with some themes as well. In the dinner, in just a very subtle way, in the dinner where Dr. Doom basically did his research to find out what Storm's favorite food was, which was our father's gumbo recipe, he was able to get Storm on the side, perfectly seduce Storm. Storm was smiling. Storm had forgotten she was in the presence of a villain. She was relaxed, ready to hear everything. But when it was time for dessert, the dessert was supposed to be made for the mutant palate. Now, it's not for Storm, but for the mutant palate. But because of different magical things that happened to Storm, she didn't like it. And it was just a little play on what people do when it comes to making assumptions on a group of people, you know. Just because I'm black doesn't mean I like watermelon. Yeah.
Oh, of course. So Doom threatens to like cut open the chef in front of her. Like
but it was his fault. But it was his fault. In the first one, it was what does she like? You know, by coincidence, I like chicken and I'm black. I love chicken a lot. You would have been correct if you went that. But it's better to know, like, okay, know people as individuals, treat people as individuals, not as members of groups, especially with the X-Men having to sometimes stand in for minorities and so many things. I think over the years as well, we may have been focusing too much on the group identity as well. As much as there should be group identity, I think stories about minority, what they should be about is these minorities should be treated as individuals. That's the point. But it's now, we're not doing what the other people wanted, to have a group name to just give them and be like the others. You know, it is these people deserve to be treated as individuals, just the way the people of the majority are treated as individuals. You know, it's like this fun thing that Dotun and I always joke about on the phone now, because we saw an artist that was cracking it, that it wasn't a joke, but was being serious, was saying that online, was saying that, oh, people don't understand how hard it is to draw people of color. It's harder to draw them than drawing normal people. And it's like, everyone is normal.
Well, let's say it's than white people, because I think normal people includes people of color.
And it's the fact that you're only seeing them as a group, not as individuals. It's still that thing. So And that's basically when the dinner starts to fail. When he saw Storm as an individual, it was working. But immediately he saw Storm as just a mutant. Like, oh yeah, this is something mutants like. Then it begins to fail. So it's just stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Jed, you similarly got to write Dr. Doom and Storm. Doom, before he launches his giant platform, confronts the Avengers, basically with the idea of, here's what each of you individually could be. What's the potential of what you could do together if you just used your powers to solve all the problems in the world? Which always takes me back to like Mark Gruenwald's Squadron Supreme story back in the 80s, which is so interesting. What happens when superheroes take over the world in a way? What was it like for you to write Doom in this scene, Storm interacting with him once again?
Yeah, I mean, I think the influences on that one were pretty broad, because if I remember correctly, or obvious, the story was called A Desert and A Temptation, A Desert and A Devil, or something along those lines. It's very much Christ's temptation in the desert, where, you know, the world is raised up, you know, from the sands and that kind of thing, where we see Doom is tempting the Avengers. He's saying, you failed. This world is imperfect. The only question is, did you fail from cowardice or lack of imagination? And in that, he shows the Avengers what he thinks could be. And, you know, in Storm in particular, he says, you know, you could secure a future for, you know, your people, for the mutants. You could ensure that they're safe, ensure that they have a home, ensure that they no longer fear persecution. And Storm, like the rest of the Avengers, I think Storm may be the first one to throw it back in his face, says, you know, no, like that's not how we do it. That's not how it works. Could the Avengers take over the world? Sure. They're the Avengers. They could, you know, crash the earth, the moon of the earth if they wanted to, but they couldn't do that and remain the Avengers. Because that's not what they do. They don't conquer the world. They don't lead the world. They save the world so that the world can save itself.
Yeah.
And I think Storm is an important character to have there to put that message out, as well as all the other ones, because no one's ever hunted Tony Stark because they're like, oh, we're going to, you know, round up all the guys with mustaches and put control collars on them. You know, whereas you could argue that Storm would have a very good reason to have a chip on her shoulder to want to take over the world and make it better, because she's seen time and time again how it has worked out for the mutants. Mm-hmm. The opening page of my latest issue of X-Men is, you know, takes place in what used to be Utopia, where, you know, Maria treated my guys quite poorly, I think, and dumped their asses there. But yeah, you know, like they've seen what happens over and over again. And if anyone's going to be like, listen, I think we're kind of tired of this shit, we're going to tear everything down and take over and make sure things are okay from here on out, it wouldn't be the most surprising turn in the world. So I think that all the Avengers obviously have a lot of skin in the game, because that's why they're Avengers. Otherwise, they would do this job. But I would say, you know, identifying Storm as someone who has perhaps a little more skin in this particular sort of area would make a lot of sense. And that's why we see Doom, you know, really going for her, really trying to get her on side, as he has done many times. Because I don't know, like, I think, like, Doom, you know, power respects power, monarch respects monarch, but also I think Doom might just be a bit down bad as well.
There's interesting ways. I love the issue you write where Carol is like, a lot of people died during Blood Hunt, like, we failed. And there's a lot of debate going on between the heroes about, like, actually, I think we did our best. Maybe we need to be better. Storm's opinion on this is valued. And something people aren't really saying out loud, and Jed, you're not making a big deal of it, which I love, that there are three characters of color on the main Avengers team right now. And Vision is often read as a character of color as well in his way. So there's kind of four, where we have Black Panther, Sam Wilson, Storm, and Vision all present in the group. And you're writing it well, plus Temper over on the X-Men, which is another fun connection between the two of you, because Temper is from Nigeria, which is fun to acknowledge all of that history. By the way, I really want to see you write Necra in an issue. I'd need to see Temper and Necra reunited. Is that something we can hope for?
Like, given that history from Sabretooth and the Exiles, it's always kind of there. I just haven't really figured out where it's going to fit. Because obviously Necra's not going to join a team of X-Men. She's, you know, Necra's too hardcore for that.
Although that would be amazing.
But yeah, I think it's one of those things where I'm just kind of like waiting for the right hole for that peg to fit in. Because I think it's a great relationship between those two that Victor wrote. I don't necessarily know if I'm fully continuing the line that he started with Temper from there, but I wanted to honor the material that had come before, the story that had come before. It's never far from my mind.
Fun fact, my first attempt to write for Marvel after I was on the Handbooks team back in 2010, nobody asked for this, I just pitched it, but I tried to write a book called Dark X-Men before Dark X-Men was a thing, and it was it was a team of like villains trying to be X-Men. It was led by Shinobi Shaw, and Necra was on the team. So like I really spent some time with this character 15 years ago. I really love her. She's one of my top favorites.
Alyssa Wong was starting at the Psylocke book. We were chatting a lot, and they were talking about Shinobi Shaw and stuff like that. I'm just like, man, it's such a funny name for a character because it's just so of the time. And but also he's just, you know, he's just a great character. He's just an absolute, you know, just a pain in the ass all the time.
Every member of the Upstarts was so gay or like weird. If you go back to that team, we talked about Trevor Fitzroy being queer coded. Yeah. Shinobi Shaw is always shirtless in a hot tub with a room full of like men, right? We've got the twins who are fucking each other, and we've got Sienna Blaze who's like, yeah, give me $100 and I'll frack the planet. That's fine. They're the gayest characters. It's really fun in this like be gay, do crimes era of the early 90s. That team always makes me smile.
Yeah. Shinobi's first appearance, he's being like rubbed down in the hot tub by like a dude with a dad mustache.
Yep. I'll do a Shinobi Shaw episode one day as well, which is delightful. I love seeing Alyssa write Shinobi. We're seeing a lot of themes explored from different areas. I love, Marewa, the soft moments that you're giving Storm. We have the giant glow-ups, but we also have her kind of snuggling with some hippos or feeding a hippo with a bottle in the Storm Sanctuary. The guest stars you're bringing in, like Maggot and Dr. Voodoo and Frenzy, are of course really delightful. But I want to focus a little bit on this kind of family dynamic that you're building with the Cosmic Marvel stuff. I'm going to go deep Handbook for just a second. This is a Mark Gruenwald thing. Someone asked the question in the 80s, like, how come everybody gets to see Eternity as like a being? Or like when we look at the Living Tribunal, these are God characters. How do we see them? And Gruenwald does this weird issue of Quasar where he introduces us to something called the Dimension of Manifestations, where there's like this little alien race who builds templates for these gods to like be able to interface with each other. And you used the Dimension of Manifestations in Storm, and I'm like, yeah, this is a guy who does his homework. That was really fun. I love what you're doing with Oblivion. Tell everybody a little about the work you're doing with this Eternal Storm concept.
I think the Eternal Storm concept started out with just, you know, let's do something cool. You know, I was thinking, you know, what can I do that can really shake things up? So the few inspirations were Donny Cates' Thor. The first volume was Thor becoming the Herald of Thunder because he was also having the power cosmic by Galactus. And there's also some of the most famous X-Men stories, which is the Dark Phoenix saga, you know. So this is supposed to be like the Eternal Storm saga. So I wanted to play around with stuff like that. But I also knew that I wanted Oblivion to be the main antagonist because even though I think in a lot of stories, death is always seen as the antithesis of eternity, I've always like, no, I think it should be Oblivion. It's always Infinity and Oblivion, but I'm like, no, I think eternity should be Oblivion. So I wanted Oblivion to be the main bad, but I just didn't want a regular mustache twirling villain. And so I've been thinking a lot about it. And while I was on a phone call with my sister, that's when the story hits me that death is Oblivion's twin sister and Infinity is Eternity's twin sister. But every time we see death and the influences of death, it's always been inside Eternity. You know, Thanos is testing over, you know, death every time.
Yeah, which cracks me up, by the way, because Infinity is kind of Eternity, but with boobs, and death is kind of Oblivion, but also with boobs.
Yeah, but he's always inside our universe. So it's like, why? She should be inside the Oblivion Void with Oblivion, but she's always in. So that means something must have separated them, because Oblivion is always alone in the Oblivion Void, not with his twin sister. And so then I was inspired by the story with my sister, where my sister is currently in the UK. And she's been there for, I think, more than 12 years now. She's naturalized now. But there was a time that, well, I was still up and coming but more so before in comic book industry, trying to get a job at, you know, all these comic cons. So I wanted to be like, okay, I don't know anyone like that's really close to the family per se in the US, but my sister is in the UK and they were doing the MCM Comic Con. That, okay, I can visit the Comic Con, know how it's like to actually like visit a proper like big Comic Con and take a sample of some of my comic books, trade around to some editors there and some, you know, professionals there, and, you know, see if I can get some jobs and stuff like that. So I applied for the visa and everything, but it got rejected. And it got rejected on the main reason that they said they didn't believe I was going to come back if I got into the UK, that I was going to stay to be an illegal. And it was just so annoying and infuriating. Like, the person I'm staying with is not an illegal. My parents go there every day. Why do you think I want to go there to become an illegal? And, you know, like, I have proofs of the comic company I'm running here, you know, so many things. So it was just so annoying and infuriating. And I suddenly realized that, oh, it's been more than 12 years and I've actually not seen my sister in person in those amounts of years. It just occurred like, oh, we've only been talking on phone and stuff. We've not seen each other in person in those amounts of years. Like, that's strange. It's so that dynamic was what inspired that story. Like, yes, like death migrated into eternity. And now Oblivion is unable to reach his sister because she is inside eternity. And then a lot of stories about colonialism and everything inspired that thing. You know, it's eternity always taking the resources of Oblivion, you know. And, you know, it's the same thing with the colonial masters. You know, you see people will say go back to your country and so many things to a lot of immigrants in, you know, in like say France or UK and this. And it's like, the reason why their country is shit right now is because you've taken all their resources, you know. So now I think they had to do a coup in Niger, but up to very recently they were taking half of the uranium exports of Niger, and the other half is sold through France. France says, oh yeah, this is the amount it is, we'll collect the money and then we'll pay you, you know. So it's that crazy. So they are basically controlling 100% of the uranium exports in Niger, and now they can't generate. So, and that's the uranium they're using to generate electricity in France. Of meanwhile, Niger has poor electricity, and it's just crazy that way. So it's easy for you to say, for someone in France to tell a Nigerian that, you know, go back to your country, you are ruining our country. Like, dude, you ruined their country first, and that's why they're here, you know. So it's that dynamic I wanted to play with. Like, yeah, we all say we don't like death in the universe, you know, if only we could be long-lived and so many other things. It's like, yeah, but death is only here because she can't go back to the Oblivion Void, because eternity keeps taking the space. There is no longer space for her. And it's just that dynamic I wanted to play with. And it fits the story of Storm. It's the perfect antagonist for Storm, because Storm has always been a form of immigrants at one stage of her life or the other. You know, she moved to Cairo at a young age from America. Then she moved to Kenya, even though her mother is from Kenya, but she was not the American Egyptian kid in Kenya, you know. And from there, she moved to the US. Yes, she was born in the US, but at that point, she already had like this mix of African accent that she felt like an outsider. Then she married a Wakandan, where they treated her like an outsider as well. And then when Krakoa happened...
Yeah, she moved to Mars.
And when Krakoa happened, she moved to Mars, where she was the outsider there. So she's always the immigrant in most of these major situations and most of these major eras in her life. So it felt like this is... Oblivion is basically Storm in that situation. They both understand that aspect.
When we first talked, Maria, the first time about your Iron Man series, I learned this about you, that you'll take something from your life that has emotional resonance and then apply it to your superhero stories. And I love your transparency on the letters page as you talk about what brings you inspiration. It's been really fun to get to know you as a writer in those ways. And I totally want to bring you back to talk about Oblivion for a character episode sometime, because he got his debut in the Iceman first limited series. series where Iceman thinks a girl is hot and discovers it's the daughter of Oblivion. he's confronting his own gayness and his fear of his parents. It's a really fun story along the way. I could obviously ask you guys 1,000 questions, but I want to keep this a little bit more Storm focused. Jed, as you have been writing Storm bouncing off of different Avengers, Black Panther is very carefully avoiding her, which is wonderful. But there's like a mutual respect that she seems to have among the heroes. Thor's like, oh, I can leave now because Storm is here. And then she gets to be the god on the team now, right? And the unique voice that you provide for her on this kind of amped up level threat. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about some of the threats that Storm is going to be facing as a member of the Avengers in the coming months?
Yeah, I mean, we're in the coming months, obviously the Avengers dealing with Doom taking over the world is going to be a big deal. We're going to see that mostly in One World Under Doom. It's one of those event situations where whenever there's an event, the Avengers are usually front and center. But that also means that we're kind of seeing less of them in the actual Avengers title because they're actually busy doing something in the other thing. Same way we did it in Blood Hunt. We're seeing some of the focus taken off the full team for a few issues during One World Under Doom. Though, of course, Storm will be coming back with the rest of them to continue to save the world. After that, we're getting into a very big story for Avengers, where we're getting beyond just sort of supervillains. We're going to start talking about the architecture of the cosmos itself. Talk about some of the really big ideas, big themes that we've been dancing around since the beginning. We're going to get up to our elbows in it, and Storm could be front and center with it. So things seem to be very tough for the Avengers moving forward.
You built a whole world, man, and I'm really excited to see where all of this goes. Just beautiful work. And I want to talk about your X-Men stuff for a whole nother hour, but we're already getting short on time. I'm really excited about the Cassandra Nova stuff, this kind of the new group 3K and the things that you're exploring about the threats mutant are facing. Jed, if I had to pick a single favorite moment from your X-Men run, I think it's issue 3 or 4, where Cyclops is having that confrontation with the director of the Office of National Emergency, just eating this giant burger while spitting in the face of oppression. And he really stands up and stands his ground and then goes into the bathroom and has an anxiety attack immediately afterward. And that, God, that's such a beautiful moment for this character. I'm really impressed with the work that you're doing. And it's really fun seeing you play in this sandbox where we get to see Alyssa writing Psylocke and, Magik being written by Ashley. And there's these different characters who are interfacing from your book, who are getting major glow ups. Juggernaut just had a huge story by Justina Ireland in Spider-Man of all places, where the cosmos of Sidorak is being really pushed forward in some ways. So there's a lot happening for your characters. It's a lot to keep track of, but you're doing a beautiful work at writing two very complex books. And I know you're writing outside of that as well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's honestly a little bit easier with X-Men. Whereas Avengers largely comes from the solo books. So, it's why the reason I think by Avengers number 4, we had 4 costume changes.
Yeah.
Generally what will happen in a solo book will be what sets the tone of what these characters are doing in Avengers. In the same way with what's happening in Thor was a convenient way to swap out Storm and Thor. Because, narratively it works, but also sort of behind the scenes it works because if someone's joining the team, someone has to leave. We're not doing 8 Avengers, let alone 2 of them with lightning powers. Whereas X-Men, with X-Men, a lot of the solo stuff kind of comes out of the main series. So we're kind of seeing things in a different direction. So it's really interesting juggling these two different teams in kind of the almost opposite direction that the demands that are put upon the characters and, put upon me here and there as well.
Yeah, and I think people don't often consider that. The X-Men continuity is really intense, but if you're writing Avengers with this team, you got to know Black Panther and Thor and Iron Man and Captain America and everything else. But my favorite thing always is when you work in a character like fucking Orifus, and I have to go, wait, where did that guy come from? It's always my favorite. Mariwa, I know there's a lot coming up for Storm going on in her most recent book. Storm's place as a mutant and as an Avenger while also having her solo adventures is a unique thing as well. It's kind of the reverse of what Jed just said, where you have to keep track of all the things, but you're keeping one strong narrative through line, knowing there's a lot happening for her in other books. How has it been coordinating with the X-Men and Avengers offices as you tell these stories? And what would you like to tell us about Storm's upcoming adventures?
Okay, the first thing I wanted to say is it's really good, like reading Jed's stuff. It's been inspiring a lot of like Storm stories that I'm not sure if a lot of people are noticing or not. I think for the example you gave, like when Cyclops was having the panic attack in X-Men on Omega, it's something we try to kind of like revisit again, that there's mm-hmm. something going on with Cyclops on the mental level. There's also is the same issue with One, the ONE. You're going to start seeing a lot of more solo titles playing around with that, including Storm and some other books, because I don't want to give spoilers for other people's titles. We're going to start seeing that coming up a little more. And it's like, so the new ideas coming in the X-Men book, it's also feeding into a lot of all the solo titles. So if you're seeing the strength of the solo titles, it's because the team books are doing what they ought to be doing. So that's been really, really good and feeding into the solo book. And for Storm's ongoing story, it's good that we mentioned Thor. The next story we're going to be telling after the X-Men on is Storm is going to be facing the Thunder Gods. You know, she's going to be facing Thor, Chak, Mamarangan. You know, she's always called herself a goddess, you know, and you know, she's referred to as a storm god. You know, what happens when the real ones show up? So that's basically the arc we're going up next. So it's going to be very action-packed. It's going to be very brutal. And, you know, we'll start seeing more secrets that Eternity has. So many secrets that Eternity has. Eternity is not particularly... Our universe is not a good place to be. So we know that Eternity is not particularly a good person. So we start seeing the secrets he's kept. Storm is not his first host. He's had several hosts in the past. That's, we've seen 12 of them die by the hands of, you know, Oblivion. You know, war was the situation with them. And then we realized that he's had a host before that was also a Thunder God, you know, and those would be one of the Thunder Gods that will be coming for Storm, you know, and, you know, so it's going to be very, very interesting, very, very action-packed.
I'm so excited to see where you go through all of this. It's such a wild concept to me when we take something like anthropomorphism, where we like to give an animal human characteristics, but we do it to something like the living embodiment of death or eternity, and like give them these human relationships and characteristics. It's a fun sandbox to play in where you zoom in and then zoom back out. The X-Men office has been together for a little while now. You guys have several months under your belt. New books are coming out. Things are being announced. And there's a flow to how things are going. It's easier as a fan to see the direction that the universe is moving in. I'm so thrilled. I don't know either of you what your personal plans for writing are or what you may not be discussing or planning in the future, but I'm so happy to see characters like Storm so deftly handled by you both. We could talk about 1,000 other things, but it's been really fun to focus on this particular character and this kind of connection between the two of you writing her at this elevated... She's not in her Beyonce era anymore. She's in her fucking goddess era. She is living larger than the earth and she gets to do whatever she wants. And there's a lot I'm really excited to see explored. I'm super grateful for the time with you both today. As we're wrapping up, we're going to put this out on May 12th. Is there anything you'd like to plug? And where can people find you online if you'd like them to be able to follow your work? Let's go Jed, then Maraywa.
My only forward-facing social media these days, or public-facing, is Blue Sky. So I'm at Jed McKay, JedMacKay. I don't use Twitter anymore. I don't use Instagram. People keep sending me Facebook friend requests. I'm not going to respond to them because I don't know you and there's no reason I would be a Facebook friend with you. So you can catch me on Blue Sky. I usually put up the days when my comics are coming out. Usually the numbers are wrong, but you know, you'll get the gist.
And Maraywa?
I'm on Blue Sky. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram, but I'm mostly active on Twitter. So you can reach me at Ayodele Maraywa, where I mostly respond to questions, you know, talk about comics, you know, fan theories, and just interact and stuff. I'm currently writing the Storm series, so keep supporting that. The X-Men on Omega might have been out by then. Try to read that. And there's an anthology that will be released, that will be announced on my Twitter page that I'll be participating in. There's that. And yeah, just as you follow, when you follow us on social media, you'll be able to get all these announcements on future big projects coming up. Because Jed has one big one coming up soon.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm excited.
Yes. Some might say too big as I'm trying to figure it out. But yeah.
I hear crossover somewhere in that without being said directly. Lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I keep my own social media private. As I got kiddos, the two of you are welcome to follow me. Just ask. Follow the show at @GrayMalkin_Lane on Instagram primarily, although you can find me on Blue Sky and Discord as well. Out on the show immediately after this same episode, my friends Andre Mason, Harem Scarum, and Numb One are joining me to review an old limited series called Aurora Before the Storm, about young Storm's days in Cairo as a thief. That will be part of this episode. So thank you, everybody, so much. Jed and Marewa, it's been such a joy to have you on today.
At Ritual, we're celebrating all moms this Mother's Day, current and aspiring. So whether you're looking for fertility support, natal choline, or our best-selling clinically backed prenatal, we've got you covered. Find your Ritual. Go to ritual.com/podcast, and for a limited time, get 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Based on net sales from industry data, including Nielsen IQ, Stackline, and Numerator as of Q4 2024 in top 5 products.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for sticking around for the second half of the Grey Malkin Lane show. We are here to celebrate Storm Aurora Monroe in a weird series. It was really crazy revisiting this one. I haven't read it in a long time. We're going to be talking about Aurora Before the Storm. This is a 4-issue limited series from 2005, and it's happening at a crazy time in the X-Men books that we're not going to really put into a lot of context. But this is one of those series that I'm kind of surprised exists. I'm honest, it's an odd little journey about little baby Storm. Well, a little preteen Storm, I suppose. I should say. This is written by Mark Sumerak with Carlo Barberi on pencils, Juan Velasco and Robert Campanella on inks, Val Staples on colors, Dave Sharp on letters, Nicole Wiley is the editor, and we have some really beautiful covers framing this book. It's very pretty. It's very Disney. This is Storm cast as Aladdin. It's kind of a fun little journey, and we're going to have a good time. I'm thrilled to welcome three of my dear friends through the show here. Let me have you each introduce yourselves with your name and pronouns, tell everybody a little about you. And my beginning question today is, what is the cutest and or most exasperating thing about adolescent Storm? Let's begin with my dear friend Harem Scarum. Welcome back to the show.
Hi there, everybody. Thank you for having me back. I'm Harem Scarum. I go by they, them pronouns. And what's the worst thing about having a little adolescent Storm? Baby Storm's kind of a badass. Like, she's got it for real. Like, she is out here stealing from people, like getting hints of, oh, there's something in me that's like going to awaken someday and be much stronger. But like, she's not there yet, but she's still a little badass running around in these streets. And I like that about her.
This limited series needs at least like 4 breakout musical numbers, and they're all kind of terrible. That's my pop. Let me also welcome Numb One Cosplay back to the show. Hi, Numb.
Hi, my name is Numb One. I go by they, them. I think the best thing, honestly, about Little Storm is the fact that she's a little badass, both in the fact like she is doing bad stuff, but also is kick-ass. I really love the fact that she just runs around and is a menace. This series specifically really is about her at, you know, her prime thieving years with, you know, her being orphaned in Cairo. So I think it's really great and really funny.
And let me also welcome my dear friend Andre Mason back to the show. Hi, Andre.
Hello. So I am a Grey Malkin regular, if you don't know. If you don't listen to the show, shame on you. Go by he, him, or girl if you're feeling saucy that day. But best thing about Little Storm is that, yeah, she's really cool. But the worst thing about this is that she looks like a Pokemon trainer. In this entire run, I was like, what's happening? Like, I was like, this is Pokemon in Cairo. So where's the closest gym?
It's definitely giving Pokemon vibes. I love Storm, but this version of Storm, she's giving teacher's pet. She's giving like the little mouse from like somewhere out there, like, you know, an American Tale, like looking out at the moon. She's giving Little Orphan Annie. She's giving Oliver Twist. There's a lot of kind of odd parallels. She's a little bit like, she's one of those kids that's like a little better than all the kids, and she doesn't know it, but also she's constantly talking about how she's better than them, even though she doesn't mean it that way. Do you know what I mean? She's walking around talking about how special she is while all the other kids are like, I wish I was like you. There's a lot of kind of odd energy. She seems a little bit unaware, which is kind of fun. I'm here for it. I think it's really delightful. Storm obviously is a character that is very, very beloved. We'll be doing the trial of Storm one day on my show. I'm going to give it a little breathing room before we get there. But Aurora, in her early appearances, we start to get flashbacks to her older life. We learn her dad was a New York photographer, I believe. Her mom was a Kenyan princess. They met, married, eventually lived in America, and then emigrated to Cairo, where they were killed in the war conflict. Storm was trapped underground for a period of time, and then she became kind of a street urchin in this war-torn city. She was taken in by a man named Ahmed El-Gabbar. Now, Ahmed is like the Fagin in the Oliver Twist story, if you guys are familiar. He's a weird version of Professor X in that he has literal child soldiers. Like, if you want to eat, kid, you better go pick some pockets. Otherwise, you don't get any food. Storm has a very loving relationship with this man, but also he's a total asshat in the story. Something very wrong with this whole picture. But he's like very grooming Storm later to be a child soldier for Xavier. We love baby Storm. There's that infamous scene where she picks Xavier's pocket and the Shadow King shows up. We also get later stories where she's wandering across Africa and falls in love with T'Challa and then becomes a weather goddess, right? So this is a particular snapshot in her history during her time in Cairo. I think they mean her to be about, I don't know, 12 years old here is the vibe that I get. And she was with El-Gabbar for a good 8 or 9 years, I think, before she started walking away. We also love baby Storm in current comics. There's storylines where like Nanny regresses her to a child form for years and Gambit meets her and calls her Ro, and she's a little thief. So baby Storm is a fun space for us to dwell in this character's history. Like, her experiences as a thief gives a lot to what the character becomes later. And I talked with Marewa earlier in this episode about how Storm is kind of always an immigrant, right? She's from America and Kenya, but she's an immigrant in Cairo. She's an immigrant when she moves forward to various places. And it's an odd thing to consider all the way up to when she goes to Mars, right?
I think that her having this very polarizing childhood from her adulthood as a goddess and her adulthood as being very, very powerful, I think grounds her a lot. I think it normalizes her, it humanizes her a lot, because she can sympathize with those she's meant to protect. She can understand their perspectives. She can understand where they're coming from. And so I think it's really actually important to who she is, because she understands what it's like to be hungry on the streets, what it's like to be discriminated against, not just because she looks different even from her peers at this age, but also because of her mutant done later on. And so I think that her finding community, her finding family, her creating her own, you know, after such massive loss at a young age, is what really sets the foundation for her being a hero, in the sense of like, I understand the plight of others, I can sympathize with them, and then as she gets older, I have the power to protect these people that can't protect themselves, to stand up for them. I think it's really important to who she is as a character, because yes, while her actions at this age are very questionable because of, you know, who she's running with and who's in control, I think she finds ways even then to protect those that aren't as strong as her, to stand up for those who need someone to help them, and to also do what's right in the midst of those, you know, telling her it's okay to do, you know, and be selfish and do things for herself.
Yeah. I think it also, right from the beginning, it's a concept of found family, right? It's a little Walking Dead-esque, like whoever survives has to get along on the streets and do what it takes. So Storm finds this group of children to belong to, and she learns very early on it's okay to steal and do what you have to protect and feed your family, which I think is a key part of her before she goes on that very individual era afterward.
I think we were always just, and this is just me, I think we were always just meant to believe that her time in Cairo or in Egypt when she was being a thief was something that was very dear and personal to her that we were never meant to explore. So when we actually did get to explore it, it was like, oh, wow. So she was not only just a thief, she was an adventurer. She was like a protector. She was like this trainer to all of these other kids who are just not used to the life of being on the street or, you know, just living that life that they were living. And I don't want to say it was a life of crime, because it was definitely survival for them. But I think it was poignant because what it did was it gave us a glimpse of her potential as a leader back then, because she was like quite literally leading a ragtag group of kids who needed guidance, who needed this ability to believe in themselves. Like, you know, at one point, you know, she was like, hey, these guys may be bigger than us, but we have to prove that we are smarter and we can outmaneuver them.
Now,
so I think there's a lot there.
I'm going to give myself permission to be a little exasperated by Aurora in this series, but As a therapist, I'm constantly telling clients, confidence is not arrogance. And one thing I know about Aurora is she knows who she is and she knows what she represents and she's here for it. She's kind of always been that way. So we have the background trauma, but we have her trusting in her skills, trusting in her gut. I'm going to open here and I can't sing this for copyright laws, but after I finish this little next blurb, Simi, I'd like you to respond first, please. So Aurora's got to keep one jump ahead of the bread line, one swing ahead of the sword. She steals only what she can't afford, and that's everything. One jump ahead of the law, man, that's all, and that's no joke. These guys don't appreciate she's broke. Riff raff, street rat, scoundrel, take that. Oh, it's sad Aurora's hit the bottom. She's become a one kid rising crime. I'd blame parents, except she hasn't got them. One jump ahead of the hoofbeats, one hop ahead of the jump, one trick ahead of disaster. They're quick, but she's must faster. Here goes, better throw your hand in, wish her happy landing, because all she's got to do is summon some motherfucking lightning.
Did you learn that from Ice Spice? I need you to get away from TikTok.
Please, it's from Aladdin. It's an Aladdin song.
It's Aladdin. I know.
But it's so true. Sorry.
Thoughts on the song? Amazing. Wonderful. 10 out of 10. Would put it on Broadway. You know what? Actually, let's get a Broadway show of Storm Girl. We've got Captain America, the Broadway show. Why not Storm?
Spider-Man, turn off the dark. Aurora in an Agrabah adventure. Okay, so we're going to jump in. We've got Preteen Storm on the first cover. It is, I thought I marked it down. I think the first cover is by Bart Sears. Anyway, beautiful cover. Preteen Storm, eyes white, her arms like spread like wings, lightning crackling, the city and the pyramids behind her. We open on, and this is a fun part of this series, there's basically only two white characters unless they're like background. And both of them are kind of shitty people. We open on kind of an Indiana Jones style adventure, but I'm going to call this guy Alabama Jones because he's so white. Alabama Jones is jumping into a Mayan temple thinking he's a grand adventurer. He's in the temple, and this is a real place of Huitzilopochtli, which is the Templo Mayor. It's an Aztec ruin in the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan. I had to practice my pronunciation. Very American bastardized, but I got the sounds right. This is the Temple of the Hummingbird. It represents sun, war, and human sacrifice. So Alabama Jones is jumping over death traps, and he has stolen La Corona de Huitzilopochtli outside his employer, a guy named Desmond Barrett. But for the duration of this series, we're officially going to call him Whitey Barrett. And he's a man dressed all in white with white hair. He looks like Dr. Nemesis a little bit, and he grabs the crown and kicks Alabama Jones to his death and is like, "Mwahaha, now we can usher in Armageddon." So young Aurora is in Egypt with her little friends. Their names are Nari and Hakim, and they are robbing at the Cairo market because they have to feed their friends living under Ahmed. And okay, we're going to just call it here really quickly. I think Ahmed has ample resources for these children, but he's employing them as full criminals just to get what he can. Definitely profiting off of like child labor while they're dressing in scraps. And he's like withholding food if they don't rob enough. It's very rough. Hakim is a little character who is very jealous of Aurora. He's very clumsy. He keeps fucking shit up. And Nari's the other kid. And she's very like, Aurora's amazing. She's my best friend. But also she runs away every time that she can. And these are her two little buddies. Storm automatically is using names or exclamations like goddess and by the bright lady, which is very akin to older Storm. But this is very much giving like, this is a 40-year-old woman in a 9-year-old child's body kind of energy. By the way, and I had to give this some thought. When Storm says by the bright lady, any theories on who she's talking about?
A part of me does want to say it's possible. Oh my God, who am I thinking of right now? What's the...
Pasha?
Maybe thinking of Ashake, her like grandmother, her like ancestral kind of like witch grandmother lady, if you know who I'm talking about.
See, I don't even think I'm thinking of Ashake. I think I'm thinking of just any African goddess that is like the lady, because there's all in like across African mythology, there is always like a mother goddess as well. In fact, this goes for a lot of different religions that have gone into myth, but there's always a mother goddess. And I know there are like a few different ones that we have across African mythology. So really, it could be any of them that she's kind of referring to, but they don't really want to use it because they didn't want to do the research that they needed to kind of pin down her specific cultural background or where she would like carry over this religious intent from, as it were.
And it's never been quite confirmed. Some people at Marvel kind of think it might be Gaia, like Mother Earth. Others think it could be Ashtar, who is one of the like Doctor Strange entities that he draws energy from.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought it was Ashtar.
I don't know if it's ever been confirmed. I think it also could be Aurora speaking to herself, right? She's seen visions, even in this episode, she sees visions of like her own potential. And I almost wonder if she's speaking to like her ultimate mutant potential.
Yeah, I feel like, don't quote me, but I feel like Ashtar at one point in time in some comics said that she favored Storm's bloodline. Mm-hmm. I think that's what she always referred to. I mean, I never knew where it came from until like years later, though. But like, don't quote me. I mean,
I think he might be like really on the money there, because I do remember at some point, since her bloodline comes from at least one Sorceress Supreme, that's a part of it as well.
Yeah, and that's what I seem to remember, that there was a conversation that was had. I just don't remember where.
I will see if I can find it while we are recording today. So we'll come back to that in a few minutes. Now, when I talk about Aurora being a little bit exasperating, here's what I'm talking about. These kids are like on the run from guards. They're trying to steal shit. One of the kids is like, help. And the other kid's like, I got to get out of here. And Storm's like leaping off buildings and saying things like, I would suffer far more if I knew I had left a friend behind, which is just like, you're just kind of, if you're a kid, this kid is like talking like that to you. You're like, you are not an adult. Like you are on our level. Okay. So they steal some food, but they lose the food because the guards corner them, which is very Aladdin. Ahmed has to come in and like get the guards to go away. Aurora takes the blame for Hakim's mistake because he dropped an apple and like disrupted her thieving. So now she doesn't get any food. Ahmed's like, that'll teach you a lesson, Aurora, which again, child labor. And like, you don't even get half an apple. So Hakim like agrees to share one with her. This also, it's interesting. Storm's like self-resilience, it almost kind of informs how she views Kitty later on to me in some ways. Like Kitty's a kid from a broken home who has a lot of potential. The most relevant part of this first issue is that Aurora is looking out at the night sky, and I'm going to give a quote here. My mother always said that the goddess smiled upon this land. On a night like this, I can almost understand what she meant. It almost makes you forget our place in the world for a moment. She also says, my mother used to tell me that I was destined for great things. She said that the blood of queens and priestesses flowed in my veins. She could only see me now. Every night I hear her words echoing in my head like a distant song, and I wait for the nothingness to finally give way to something more. It never does. I still dream my parents will return someday. They are still out there somewhere alive. Somewhere where dreams may come true. Like she's very that. There's a little mouse singing to her across. And Hakim's like, bitch, both of my parents abandoned me. At least yours loved you. Like, fuck. God, you stop. Like, pay attention. So the next day, Aurora robs some more guys. She evades some guards. And then she sees her teacher, Ahmed, meeting with a white man and accepting a case of gold while agreeing to send some of his children into dangerous territory to commit a thieving assignment. So Ahmed's ethics are all over the place. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that summary of the first issue before we move forward. What are your thoughts on Hakim, Andre?
He understands certain things, but then he just doesn't. Like, he's like, I need the guidance, but I'm too afraid to say it. So I'm just going to kind of listen. Which, again, goes back to the fact that these are following a very particular archetype for the future team members that she has. So I think that Hakim is like, he's bright, but he's also terrified. Like, he's like, I can't keep doing this. I can't, like, live like this. You got it. I don't.
What are your thoughts on Nari Num?
I knew you were going to ask me that. Honestly, coming from, like, the background that I come from, and like having a big family and like knowing like different personalities and stuff, her interactions are the way that me and my siblings interact. Very much like the one is the know-it-all who also is like kind of a dick to the ones who aren't as strong or capable. Like the part where she tells Aurora, like, he's not gonna make the jump, like, we know he's not, let's just move on, like, leave him behind. Like, that's ruthless sibling behavior. So like, I very much love the dynamic she brings. I also kind of sense like a, she knows she's good, but she's also like, I'm not trying to get caught up like y'all are. I gotta bounce, I'm taking care of me. So I can see how like self-centered she can be, which also is very understandable given their background and things. But she cracks me up because she's so ruthless to them when Aurora like is the opposite and is so kind and like helpful. And she's like, no, I'm good. I'm gonna go.
Now, do you want to guide us into the next issue? Tell us what happens in issue number 2. And the cover on this one is by Randy Green. It's a really pretty, like, Aurora in, like, archaeologist gear, in, like, an Egyptian tomb. It's fun.
Yeah. Issue 2 starts with, basically, Aurora on the run. You're not really sure what she's running from, and then you realize that it is a test for the other children to catch her for Achmed. And so she's basically training the littles to become better. She obviously defeats them all, and, you know, basically rubs it in their faces a bit. But when Achmed shows up near the end of this, he basically reminds her of how good she is and rewards her. As they transition through the issue, he then brings them to the dig site where they are supposed to go and start robbing for our resident white man.
Yeah, Whitey Barrett. We're just going to call him Whitey Barrett.
Who doesn't realize that Achmed is employing children. So he assumes that Achmed is going to be using his older thieves to do this work. And when he realizes that he's brought children, is a little bit hesitant, pulls Achmed aside, and they discuss it before then Aurora and the children basically saying, we are fully capable of doing this. We believe in ourselves, and you should trust us to get the job done.
Achmed's like, they're 9. It's fine. They might die. That's also fine. And the guy's like, okay.
What I do appreciate here is that they go in together and they recognize both their strengths and weaknesses once they immediately get inside. Aurora is very clearly claustrophobic still. So it takes her a minute to re-regulate herself before she can get going. Hakim obviously ruins it all with his clumsiness and sets off all the booby traps possible. And Nari is basically just roasting them alive. As they progress through the dig and through each of the trials and tribulations, Achmed waits for them outside. When Whitey Barrett asks him to leave or, you know, encourages him to go, Achmed does show that he cares for his pupils, cares for the children, and he refuses and decides to stay. While I do question his morality, I do also align him very much with Charles Xavier, who sends his child soldiers off to battle, but doesn't necessarily abandon them entirely. He is watching. Watching and he is waiting, listening.
This man took a whole carton of gold and he did not tell those children.
But neither does Charles. Charles just sends them off on missions, barely giving them any details. As they make it through, they finally make it to the heart of the dig, and there they find a giant pillar with prophecies engraved on it. We see a few of them as we look, and a stone man with a very pretty gem in his hand that they have realized they have been sent to steal, along with 4 other stone statues, which as soon as they take the gem, then come to life. And that is where the issue ends.
Yeah, so they're here for the Opal of Ozymandias. Ozymandias is a character that is part of Apocalypse's origins. He was a king that got turned into a big stone statue who now is like doomed to chronicle these like prophecies of Apocalypse in this like sub-basement in Egypt for hundreds of years. I have an episode on Ozymandias with Anthony Oliveira and Leah Williams out there on the main show, so feel free to go listen to that if you'd like more on this character. But these kids, they like jump over alligators. They almost get eaten by scorpions. They almost get crushed. Like, this is full child endangerment.
Like, immediately almost get crushed. It's the first trap, which, you know, speaks to her claustrophobia. They're scaling walls. They're walking tight ropes that snap. They're basically doing anything and everything that you can think of. There are fireballs shooting at them. And they're just handling it with ease.
Also, Aurora has major, like, claustrophobia and PTSD. And they're like, here, go in this dark tunnel. You'll be fine. I'm sure it will be great. Did you notice in the hieroglyphics, it's definitely Wolverine. He's like a savage guy with claws, but he seems to be fighting like an odd lizard man. Like, maybe Wolverine fights Spider-Man villain the lizard at some point in the future.
Main thing that I had thoughts on is definitely them jumping over the alligator pit, because again, these are in fact not just the alligator pit, the fire traps, the scorpions, the little tightrope, which I can almost give for the tightrope, because that's just like, all right, they got a handles on the bridge or anything, they can get across that, sure, whatever. Everything else, none of these kids. Quicksand, how did you get out? I've heard so many times in my life, quicksand is the most dangerous thing that you can come upon if you ever come upon it. What happened here?
Are these immortal crocodiles and alligators? Like, they've been in there for like 300 years. How are they eating? They're just in this pit waiting for someone to fall in. Like, did Apocalypse curse them with the curse of Ozymandias? Or maybe Ozymandias has to feed the alligators like once a week. That's part of his like eternal torture. Harem, tell us about issue 3. This is a Patrick Zercher cover with like Aurora standing in front of like storm hieroglyphics, like her as an adult.
So basically we have back to the camp and everything. They're talking to Barrett about everything that went down, that they got the opal and that they're going to begin the ceremony now. In fact, Ahmed was peeking in. He shouldn't have heard anything about this because obviously this is a super secret ceremony of whatever is about to go on. But they're getting ready. They're preparing. The kids aren't up there yet with the opal yet. They've now got to deal with Apocalypse's guards that are
being... Well, before you get there really quickly, Apocalypse has that like clan Akaba who follows him, right? Like they're like these... It's like a 1,000-year-old cult that's like waiting for his return. This doesn't seem to be that. Whitey Barrett seems to be working with some like cultists and they plan to like revive Apocalypse and then like have ultimate power in his name. So it's some sort of kind of odd tangential cult. We kind of don't quite know what their deal is. But Ahmed's like, holy shit, what's happening here?
So he just wants nothing to do with it, which fair, because it's very, who's going to deal with this kind of bullshit this early in the day or this late at night? So they go into, they're still in the temple. They're fighting off these giant temple guardians like it's nothing. Again, these are children. I am still very much on the fact that these are children, and they think, well, the opal's ours now because they think they get away until another big ass bitch comes after them. I think the biggest of the bitches, really, if we're gonna be honest. And it's like I don't know how these kids are doing this. They're breaking these things like it's nothing. They're leading them into walls to make sure they crumble upon the floors of the temple. They're getting away with it until it seems like they get captured by, again, the biggest bitch, at least two of them. Aurora got out. She's fine. But she's going to be like, okay, let me give the prize that obviously the guardian wants, and he'll follow me below, so then my friends will not get hurt, or brothers, or as it were. And
it
then
might
we
just be, it might just be that Ozymandias is a really shitty strategist, too. He's just, like, really shit at controlling statues.
No, very much. Because we get her talking to Ozymandias. Okay, so you're the temple guardian. So these all belong to you. But he's like, nothing belongs to me. Everything is for the master and Salvador. He made sure of this way before any of us were born, way before you were born. But I serve you today, so I'm going to help you out a little bit so we can get you to where you need to go. Because look, pray tell, who is on this wall. And it's Storm, as far as we know, being bowed down to by others for her power that is obviously inside of her. Storm is like very confused by this, which is very fair. But Ozymandias,
this hieroglyphic is giving like Egyptian goddess in a way. And there's like this circle around her head with like an X on it, which is very much like the ascension kind of thing, right?
Which is starting to make me think Xavier had to have gone into this temple to see this at some point.
Yeah, because there's a carving of Professor X and Cyclops underneath Storm on the wall, which is crazy.
Exactly. And then he made this exact outfit for her later on. Like, so is it self-fulfilling prophecy, or is it just, no, like this got beamed into him in a dream one day. It was like, I'm going to make her the baddest bitch that anybody could make her. But everything's a little weird. Ozymandias is telling her, no, yeah, this is you. I'm showing you the path that you are going to be on. It's going to be long. It's going to be difficult. But once you get up there, you will be the savior of everyone. You are going to save so many lives. Aurora still doesn't believe it. She doesn't believe that could ever be her. And he's just like, you know what? Sure, whatever. Your journey's still beginning today. I can't really stop that for you. But here is the opal. Take it and be warned, there is a great cost to this power. Now, get the hell out of here.
Ozymandias, we did his voice like very like, like that kind of energy when he's talking. He gives her like a, you'll someday help your people to a brighter tomorrow. You're destined for great things. And as she's like walking away, he gets this evil little shit-eating grin on his face. And do you notice what's on the wall behind him? Because this is fucking great.
It's the X-Men carved right there.
Well, first of all, it's a Roman numeral in an Egyptian tomb of the 12. Yeah, it's a reference to the 12, Andre's favorite X-Men story of all time.
That is actually wild as hell. I thought that was just like an wild X with the man kind of cut off there.
So this is a story that's like playing out in the comics over a period of years. The idea of the prophesied 12, and it never really goes anywhere, but it's very associated with Apocalypse. So this story almost seems to be seeding that very unsatisfying 12 story later on.
It's actually amazing how much we do not get payoffs for Apocalypse when you think about it, but... it is what it is. People like to drop, like, once you get new editors, new writers, people will drop a story if they don't really feel into it. So they're still waiting for everybody, like, elsewhere. The other street urchins are waiting around. And that's when we get a little bit of trouble outside their window. But we're not going to focus on that because we're back at the temple. So they're trying to get out now. They're just kind of talking about the stone freak that just talked to Storm about whatever destiny she's about to go through. And she says, you know, you just kind of told me stuff. Just what I needed to hear to kind of get through. And then we have the temple beginning to crash down on them, to crumble down. And again, as we've seen from previous issues, Nari's the only one who's okay. But as we've seen from previous issues so far, she's not one to stick around to help anybody out. So Nari gets out of there. At least she tries to go and find Teacher, but it's not like she can really do anything to get them out first. So then we have, what's that guy's name?
Barrett. So Barrett dropped all of this on the kids with the plan to crush them. Like, I'm going to kill these small children and then I will dig through the rubble to find the opal. But luckily Nari ran out with the opal in her hand.
So basically she messed up a little bit. And then we see that Barrett has power from, or I'm not sure if the power comes from the opal, but once he got it in hand, he definitely started.
I think he's a mutant.
No, he is a mutant. Yep.
Yeah, it might come from the crown that he got earlier, but he's a mutant that can generate fire is what is implied.
Okay, I had to make sure because I was like, hold on a second. Does he just have these powers or is he just a guy? Just need to know.
He was a fire generating mutant. Yeah.
Let's go. And he goes to threaten Nari and we get a continue to the next issue.
And then Andre, do you want to keep us going with issue 4? This is a Stuart Immonen cover. I like Stuart Immonen a lot, but I don't like this cover a lot.
Yeah, it wasn't really flattering.
Yeah, it's like the three thieves in an alley with some lightning behind them. But it's kind of, I don't know. I like Immonen a lot, but this is not my favorite of the cover.
It was not. I mean, I think up until that point, like, you had this very kind of LA Garza looking art, and then you kind of muddied the waters with that one. So I definitely understand. Okay, so issue 4 literally starts with a flashback and understanding a little bit more about Storm and her basically her trauma around her parents' death. But in the middle of all of this trauma, she realizes that she is buried under the rubble in the temple, and we see for the first time Storm's powers kick in by trying to get out of this rubble. So she sees Hakim's arm and she's like trying to break him free, and she does so using her powers again. So it's in the name. She doesn't understand what's happening. She clearly has no idea that she's a mutant, but she just knows that she has to get Hakim out, essentially that they almost died here. So, you know, they get out and they understand that they have to get back because they are separated from Nari. They get back to the temple where the other street urchins were, and it's completely empty except for one of the little kids who are still there. And I can't remember. I think it was Abdul, right?
Yeah, it's Abdul. But that means Ahmed brought all of the street urchins with him.
Yes, because there's a master plan. There is a master plan. We'll get to that. So Abdul tells him, like, hey, a bunch of people came, a bunch of henchmen came and grabbed all the kids, and I don't know what happened, but, you know, that's where they went, but I can show you where they went. So Abdul takes Storm and Hakim to another excavation site, and lo and behold, there's the biggest fucking sarcophagus you ever did see with Apocalypse sitting inside, because this has all been Barrett's master plan. Somewhere he had found out about the first mutant Apocalypse and wanted to resurrect him by basically sacrificing all of these kids to wake him. I don't know how he knew that, but that's what he was going to do. So they're overhearing all of this stuff that's happening, and basically Storm is kind of coming up with the plan, and she believes that they have the element of surprise because she believes that Barrett believes that they had died in that crash. So they're going to be able to enact a really great plan to basically stop him. So they do so, and then Ahmed shows up and he's like, hey, you know, you can't sleep on these kids and they're far greater than what you think. And then Storm and Hakim basically wreck shop, freeze them all, and just beats up all of the henchmen. But of course this angers Barrett. He turns on his powers and he's like, you can't really do this and I'm gonna stop you. And so basically he, like, I'm gonna be a child murderer right now and just get rid of you all. A fight ensues. I think one of the kids grabs the crown. Barry gets really, really upset because he needs that to wake an Apocalypse. But unfortunately, Nari gets in the way and she gets blasted. So basically he's like, you know, give me the opal. Everything will be fine. I just need to do this. Storm doesn't want to, but, you know, as it goes, she will basically give him what he needs. And then She gives the opal to him. He puts it in the crown. He puts the crown on, and then he starts turning into stone.
It's very Indiana Jones when, like,
it is very Indiana Jones.
When he drinks from the wrong chalice, and then he likes them all, like,
or even just opening up the casket of destiny or whatever it was.
And the covenant.
Yeah.
It's always this thing. Like, even in the Ark of the Covenant, you know, the Nazis didn't know exactly what it was going to give them, because, you know, they were into the arcane. But Barrett believed that it would offer him immortality. And in the most ironic fashion, it turned him into stone.
I think this man ends up as, like, Ozymandias's bitch. Ozymandias is made from rock, and now this man's torment is he has to be Ozymandias's bitch for the rest of eternity.
So we end the issue with basically Storm kind of understanding what just happened, but now she has a renewed sense of purpose. And she's like, you know, I saw basically into my future, and I'm kind of looking forward to it. So this is just a stopgap. This is something that is temporary for me, and I'm going to basically live my life until I get to that next step.
And we end with Ozymandias looking up at that, like, hieroglyphic of Storm once again, which is lovely, and it gives very Bright Lady energy, right? Now, I did look this up while we were talking. There is a series of Marvel magic books called Mystic Arcana. I think that's the reference here, but it is mentioned that Oshter prefers the line of Storm. We're going to be doing some Marvel magic in the late summer on my show, so stay tuned. We'll cover that in more detail.
Is that the one that, like, talks about the tarot and how everybody appears in the tarot deck, where Scarlet Witch, Storm, and somebody else is the priest?
Magic, Sister Grimm. There's a whole bunch of characters featured here. This is written by, back when I was on the handbooks, one of my fellow writers, a guy named David Sexton. David put all this stuff together. So I'm featuring David on the show this summer, which I'm excited about. Storm's self-possession is almost my favorite part of this whole series. I'm talking about her being exasperating, but it's in a cute way, right? She, like, knows who she is. She knows she's something special. She's been told it her whole life, and she doesn't think of herself as better. She just knows what she has to offer. And I love that about this character. She doesn't doubt unless she's failing. But Ozymandias puts a shit ton of pressure on this child as well, right? When I was a kid, I had not the easiest of childhoods, and I grew up Mormon. And in Mormonism, you get this thing when you're a teenager, if you choose, and if you're quote unquote worthy, where this, like, old man will lay his hands on your head and give you, like, a treasure map for your life, basically. It's called a patriarchal blessing. It's a whole Mormon thing. You can look it up. At the time, you believe it's inspired, but, you know, when you grow up and leave the church, it's not. And there was a whole bunch of shit, like, I still have it. There's a whole bunch of shit said, Chad, your life has been really, really terrible, and it's probably going to get worse. But if you just hold on tight, you're going to be able to change all kinds of people's lives. Like, your suffering is complicit to your ultimate destiny, where you get to sacrifice yourself for a better world. And so Ozymandias, like, giving this, like, prophecy to Storm here, I was like, no, I don't like that.
Honestly, kind of wild when you think about it, because, again, she's kind of, it's not really destiny, as it were. It's more like self-fulfilling prophecy at a point. It's like she's stepping into these shoes that are said to have been written for her, but maybe it was only written for her because of this reveal to her. Mm-hmm. Maybe she was sent on this path specifically because of the reveal. But if, let's say Ahmed had never gotten this job, he had never sent these kids to his temple, what would Storm's path be at that point? Would she still find her way to the X-Men's destiny someday? Or would she live an entirely different life?
Well, now you sound like the Watcher.
What if?
Andre, what were your thoughts on how Storm's powers activated here? Do you think this was the first time?
I believe so. I mean, I want to say that it was, because she was very much like, I don't know how this happened. I was praying to the Bright Lady for power and strength to get out of this situation, and it just happened. So to her, it was just like a blessing was bestowed upon her, not necessarily a mutant power or her X gene activating. But again, it goes into how Storm is a very quiet force, even at this age. So her powers kicking in the way they did and how it was just like, boom, I've arrived. Like, this is it. So I thought it was very cool.
Num, I can tell you fucking loved this series. You are beaming ear to ear. You can praise it all you like. What did you love about this series?
So I always love a good throwback Storm childhood story. One of my favorite, actually, and I'm going to plug this author, Tiffany D. Jackson. She just wrote a novel. It's called Storm, Dawn of a Goddess. It is an amazing amazing perspective given to Aurora from that early childhood stage where she, you know, obviously is going through, you know, the loss of her parents, but that's not the focus. The focus is her time as a thief in Cairo and her meeting T'Challa and her going on this adventure and her being called essentially back home. It really ties into this mysticism and this, you know, hereditary sense of magic and power that she has in herself, actually being the reason that she ends up kind of leaving the thieves and her family that she had built in Cairo to go back home to Kenya and be worshipped as a goddess there. I'm still not knowing that she's a mutant. For this perspective, my brain like takes all the like my favorite pieces of all of these stories and kind of just like lumps them into one. So this story just like fits in like, oh, it's before the novel, before she really meets T'Challa and like, you know, goes back home. It's like, I just love it because I think it's fun. I think it's very enjoyable. I don't take it any like bit seriously at all. I love how we get to see her being herself, but like small and cute and adorable. Even though there are times I'm like, I work with children this age. Like, I know for a fact they're not like using these grand like speeches and they're not talking to each other that way. They're like, they're basically name calling and, you know, showing off.
I don't even think they know sentence structure like this yet.
They're like, no.
If Ozymandias can use Roman numerals, then these kids
can. Anything goes in comics, but in all seriousness, I think it's so much fun. I think the prophecy portion of this, I think is a very great storytelling tool because of course, like Apocalypse being this massive presence in Marvel and in specifically for the X-Men, I think trying to tie it unsuccessfully to the 12, I think would have had more payoff if there was like a bigger, like, I remember you in the caves or the tunnels, mm-hmm. you know, as a little girl and her being like, the hell?
Well, another odd payoff is another of the 12 is the living pharaoh, who is an Egyptian mutant, like directly connected to Apocalypse. So there was a way that we could have tied that through, yes. like easier, you know?
I like the story just in the sense of like, I like getting pieces of their childhood. You don't get a lot of them for our heroes. So giving it to Aurora, I think is such a great way of like really bringing her back down to earth.
In a post-Krakoan era, I know some people are feeling frustrated about the books and like finding their place. The top quality book though, my single favorite out of the print comics is Storm. But Storm is being written beautifully by Marewa and by Jed in the Avengers. If you're following her, she is in her goddess era. She's advanced beyond her Beyonce era and now she's in her full goddess era, living in the eternal storm, working for eternity. She's got a big old house. She snuggles with hippos at night and she's having crazy adventures. I think it's beautiful. I don't know if you guys saw that scene where she gets to, like, it's the flashback to her with her dad and he's feeding her veggies and she's like, I'm probably gonna die after I eat this, so good luck, dad. And then she gets to be reunited with her dad in the afterlife, in the like present moment. Beautiful, beautiful. What are your thoughts on Storm in the current comics?
Okay, I'm gonna take the lead on this one because I have a lot of big feelings. But I love a good horror like possession story, like film, movie, whatever it is. And for me, I've always seen the Phoenix that way. Obviously, you know, through the development, we know that Jean and the Phoenix are one and the same. But her being possessed by Eternity in this series, her very much like having to fight for her autonomy, I think has been the most interesting part of these stories. On top of the fact that like she knows exactly what she's about now and she stands on business. I love the inclusion of Maggot. I love that she's like got her own thing, her own business in a sense going on. And you know, with the current things going on, I feel like we're about to see something very interesting happen with her being pushed into this very different sphere of power of these beings that are outside of the general norm for her to interact with. Like, it's not very often she gets to interact with Eternity. Like, I think it's happened only once before. And then on top of that, now she's being pushed into a more cosmic stage, which is both interesting and terrifying because our poor girl has already had to face basically death itself just to be resurrected by someone who took control of her body. So it's like a lot, but I love it.
That 3-page spread of her like putting on her lingerie and tucking the knives in and then that big old green dress. I was like, fuck yeah! Like, it's so good.
That's my
girl right there. I really do like that they're standing. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, I'm saying I'm working on the green dress right now. I'm scared of it.
As you should.
Don't look at me.
We have faith.
We have faith.
Yes.
Andre promised to come in that lingerie look to the Uncanny Experience, right?
I did not. Listen. Someone is trying to talk me into doing Bishop's first Hellfire Gala. You know, the red crop top jacket.
Well, then you should.
Maybe. So we'll see.
What are we doing arguing over it? You should. The whole world wants to see it. Chat, leave a comment.
I speak for the world. We do.
Peer pressure.
So, Num, I want to piggyback off what you said because that is how I felt after the fact. Mm-hmm. What I did not enjoy, and I think my first impressions was, why are we mirroring Jean? Like, did we have to have Storm go through the same exact thing as being possessed by this cosmic entity? Why couldn't she just do something different? Why couldn't this cosmic entity just show her what her potential is instead of pushing it like Jean's did? So I was on the opposite camp, like, why are we doing this? But then I let it marinate, I let it cook, and then, okay, so this is a little bit different because, like you said, she has a bit of autonomy that Jean did not. So I think that was a major difference.
It's interesting hearing you guys to describe it as possession. I read it more almost like Galactus powering up a herald. You know what I mean? Like I'm going to amp your powers way up because she's like she's being selected to fight against whatever like Oblivion's appointed thing is. And I know there's an upcoming issue where she's fighting off against all of the other like actual gods of lightning and thunder across the planet, which is, so I mean, there's some cool cosmic stuff. It's going to be interesting to see where it goes.
The reason I feel like it is possession, though, is because when she has that conversation with Doom and Eternity is possessing her at that point, her hands are shaking because she's fighting him off. Mm-hmm. And then the issue ends with her in tears back at Thundercloud, back at her base.
Mm.
And so the most recent issues, sorry guys, spoilers.
This isn't coming out until May.
Well then, no spoilers, you should have read it by now. But in the current X-Man hunt, the hunt they're doing with Charles right now.
Yeah.
She gets that switch, Eternity takes over, and Psylocke is like, hey, that's not Aurora. That's not who you are. Come back, fight back. And then she takes her body back and she's like, oh, I'm back. And Magic makes it very clear. It's like, there's something else driving right now.
Yeah, but also Xavier seemed to push that button a little bit too. Fuck that guy.
Listen, he ain't got no leg to stand on because he shouldn't be talking about being possessed by nobody.
The father of Onslaught.
Yeah.
The man's a monster.
I really like that they're standing 10 toes down with like thrusting her into mysticism because there's always been the hints of it throughout the years of Storm. She has always been hinted to come from a powerful mystical line. She's like, well, straight up said that she's come from a powerful mystical line, but we've never really seen her kind of in her magical era except for a scant few times. And now, like, you know, people are just like, oh, it's just the mutantism. She's not actually that powerful to stand next to the likes of Doctor Strange, next to the likes of the Scarlet Witch. She's not powerful enough to stand beside gods, which she is worshipped as. And now they're like really pushing her into her era of like, no, she could attain godhood at any time if she wanted to. She can attain these, like, she can control these powers in more ways than you guys are even aware of. She has this in her, and it's time for everyone to stop denying that she has that in her. And I think that's my favorite thing about this era, that it's like there's no denial of what she is. Yes, she is a mutant, but she is also a goddess, a witch, all of these things.
You say, which is Jean in the Phoenix story as well. Another thing I really love about the current era is, speaking as a kid who was oversaturated by Wolverine and Deadpool and Ghost Rider in the 90s, you know, there are like five X-Men characters that are appearing multiple times a month right now. One is Wolverine, one is Storm, and then we've got characters like Psylocke and Magic filling the bill as well, which I think is fantastic, right? We're seeing some glow-ups, and Storm on the Avengers is like a major book, and the Avengers is featuring three characters of color among the cast right now, and they're all very different and have very complex relationships. So it was really fun to interview Jed and Marewa about their plans. And it's really fun to analyze those parts of the books as well.
Listen, I was here for the Black Avengers when they were the Ultimates. I need that title back.
Al Ewing, yes. Like, so
good. Anything like that puts Blue Marvel center, I'm fine with that too.
except if it's that original Blue Marvel series, because fuck that guy in that series specifically.
Oh yeah, that one was bad, yeah.
I love Storm so much, and also
Same.
Can't believe she fucked Wolverine in those woods.
No.
In the middle of a hurricane she
Come
created.
On, are you not shocked at that? Like, she...
I'm never Wolverine. Shocked at it. Like, that's her Listen, man right there.
That is her that is her childhood blanket. That's her crib blanket. She goes back to that for comfort. That wasn't shocking at all. What would be shocking if she didn't do that?
It's wild to me. I've befriended Annie Nascenti, who's like a childhood hero of mine. I have Annie on the show when we were talking about her Storm series from a couple of years ago. And I propose, like, I really want to write this scene someday. We get a scene where Storm orgasms so hard that, like, lightning blasts the roof off the house. Like, and you just see her, like, whoa, that was amazing afterward.
The holes in the listen, wall. Listen, I don't care. Where's Craig? I need Craig back.
Black Panther continuously like, please don't go back to him. I'm begging you.
Please, I love the preview so much. I'm so pleased we get to nerd out regularly. And I can't wait to hang out this summer. Harem, are you coming to Uncanny?
I'm going to try.
Okay.
I am going to try.
Please do.
We have a good time. It would be delightful to see you in person. But no, Andre, I can't wait to hang out in July. It's going to be so wonderful. Yeah. As we're wrapping up, we're going to put this out in mid-May. Tell people where they can find you. Any final thoughts and anything you'd like to plug?
Hi, everyone. I'm Num1, X-Men Cosplay. You can find me on Instagram. I'll be all around, you know, being a regular menace. By the time this comes out, I'll have finished everything for Awesome Con, Free Comic Book Day, and we'll be gearing up for our Uncanny experience in the summer.
Hi. So you can find me at Harem Scarum Gospel on Instagram. I'm so sorry. I am like, I just got off of work technically.
Now I'm wishing this at Sherna, your turn.
You can find me at Harem Scarum Cosplay on Instagram. You may find me at various different conventions giving my panel on monster fucking, where we kind of do a little bit of a deep dive into the different psychological reasons as to why we may find ourselves very attracted to monsters. We had a really good one at BlurredCon this year. I really like the audience participation in that. And if anything, I will switch gears from working on my Wicked Part 2 cosplay for Elphaba to switching to something more X-Men themed, because I do have an unfinished Scarlet Witch somewhere in my closet. So, you know, I will come to the Uncanny Experience if I'm pressured enough.
The Uncanny Experience is the most favorite con I've ever been to. Both years in a row, I was smiling for days and like crying. I was so happy a couple of times. No joke. Like, I'm a man in my 40s. It's the happiest, most wonderful place. I really love it there.
You can find me on socials everywhere on Talk Nerdy to Me, and that's TALKNRDY, the number 2ME. And pretty much you'll find in these socials that I am just a aging pop culture enthusiast, but I'm having fun with cosplay right now. So besides the Uncanny Experience, you will find me at Star Wars Celebration in Japan next month.
Oh, take me.
So that is going to be really cool. But outside of that, I mean, you know, shows for the remainder of the year will happen, so you guys can catch me cosplaying. By the time this show comes out, it should be out, but I'm going back as Bishop to Uncanny Experience. That's going to be really fun with my new baby prop, so.
I would like to make an addendum. You will also see me at the Star Wars Experience, because I'm going to be sneaking into Andre's fucking suitcase so I can go.
Listen, I'm taking United, so my first bag is free, so.
Therapy hat on for a moment for my fellow queer friends out there. Find queer spaces where you can smile with other queer friends. It is a life-saving activity in this current political climate with the work that I'm doing. So thankful to each of you. Thank you for your time and talents this evening. Lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos. The three of you are welcome to add me. Just ask. You can follow the show at @GrayMalkin_Lane. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. We'll continue to work in Storm content as we move throughout the year. I love being in this kind of 1975 era. And I think I have plans for all three of you to come back on the show, which I'm thrilled about. So thank you for hanging tonight. We will see you all back here very soon on Grey Malkin Lane. Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.
At Ritual, we're celebrating all moms this Mother's Day, current and aspiring. So whether you're looking for fertility support, natal coline, or our best-selling clinically backed prenatal, we've got you covered. Find your Ritual. Go to ritual.com/podcast and for a limited time, get 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Based on net sales from industry data, including Nielsen IQ, Stackline, and Numerator as of Q4 2024 and top 5 products.